Hi, I'm Irma Minerva at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and this is your podcast of the week.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to see everyone here, and a real pleasure to welcome Dr. David Carr. This is a presentation. I'm Benjamin Filene. I'm the director of the Public History Program here at UNCG, and this is a presentation put on by the History Department in collaboration with the University Libraries and the Weatherspoon Art Museum. And I first want to be sure to thank Kimberly Lutz of the University Libraries and Anne Grimaldi of the Weatherspoon for working together with me to organize all this. We're really excited that it's come together. I hope you'll join us afterwards for a reception in the lobby. And as I say, it's an honor to have David Carr here. I think sometimes the treasure in your own backyard you don't always fully recognize, and Dr. Carr is indeed that. He's a leading voice in a national conversation about what are cultural institutions good for, and how do we justify our existence, and how do we make our way through the changing world. He's written two books that I imagine many of you know. If not, I encourage you to look at The Promise of Cultural Institutions and A Place, Not a Place. And in those books, he helps us think about, you know, what does learning look like, how does learning happen, what does it mean, and what is it good for, in ways that bring together libraries and museums and the universities that train the workers who then go on to work in the libraries and museums. He brings together all of those institutions, reflective of the audience we have here today. And he brings them together in a way that helps us think about our future as cultural institutions. How are we going to need to change, and what things must we not change? So altogether, he's one of the leading voices, as I say, in helping us chart a future for cultural institutions. And we're grateful for him to come talk to us today. The title of his talk is Museums, Libraries, and the Rescue of American Voices. Welcome, Dr. Carr.
Benjamin, thank you very much, and thank you, thanks to Kimberly and Anne as well for the arrangements. Thank you for coming. Nice to see you. Yes, libraries, museums, and schools, all in one place. It's sort of unusual to think we are so close to each other and so deeply embedded, and yet we rarely have the kinds of interactions that might cross some of the borders that we so carefully defend. And I also want to thank you for coming here today, because I know you're all probably pretty upset, grieving for those bankers who are going to have to learn to get by on $500,000 a year. I feel so sad, so hard. One day we'll all be, and you can see as well that I'm a librarian, right? I never travel anywhere without six books, at least. I give a lecture about the habit of reading. And I have a series of questions that I ask at the beginning of that lecture. And one of the questions is, you're going to be going away on a trip for two nights. What is the proper number of books to take? Four, five, six. And if you have taken six, how many do you buy in the airport before you leave? This is a nice time of day. It's a time in the afternoon when we can all imagine what's happening in libraries and museums. And we can further imagine in libraries and museums everywhere in America. In libraries, kids have left school behind as much as they can and have come to work on projects or homework, to explore the web, to be with each other, and surely to be distracted. Perhaps their parents are with them, probably not. There are already users in the library, we know, using its computers, looking for work perhaps, pursuing something we cannot see. And in an hour or so, adults may be stopping by on their way home, check for a book they heard about, say on National Public Radio during the day, or to look over the automobile evaluations, to consider a course that they might want to take at a community college, or to linger over and select from a CD collection. DVD, or to ease their worries with good information about the health of someone they love. museums of art or history or in an archive, a different group of users has gathered, probably older and less certain of their task. They have different problems. They want to read a war doc or examine a sepia photograph on gathering. They want to find out something about this place in a particular time or encounter an artist's imagination of something also. They want to see a collection of ceramic photographs, perhaps to inspire their own work. Or they want simply some solace from the quiet privacy that they find without asking. Lives are happening in these places, even as I speak of them. And they are all mysteries to us. They're all hidden from us. And they're all part of us. Because we are all interested in living in a community that holds and nourishes such lives, these human individuals. And as it nourishes them, it, the community, what if, at this hour of the day, everyone in these places, child and adult, in Greensboro and America, as if guided by an instinct for communication and connection, what if each one were to look up from their purposes and turn to another person and safely ask, "Can you tell me what task brings you here today?" And in the same fresh way of being present for each other, what if the person asked, or to respond easily, "Well, I'm looking for this." And then, say for 10 minutes or 15, a conversation, at least a million conversations across the nation, were to happen about the questions and evidences at hand, about the experiences and the practices in progress, the unknown, resistance or becoming small, the processes and accomplishments that are so carefully thought. And then, each would turn back to their process and experience, child and adult, in order to work a little more on whatever has brought them, and then get on with itself. Yes, it's a dream, but when are we not dreaming? In Hometown, the great nonfiction work by Tracy Kidder, the author imagines, and this is a book that I have used when teaching collection, so that my students will begin to see the values. In Hometown, the author imagines taking the roof off of every place in Northampton, Massachusetts, the place he's excavating as an observer. The passage, coming somewhat early in the book, appears to be a revelation of what he has come to understand about the place. A great deal lay hidden and half hidden in this small, peaceful town. Well before you understood all of it, you would feel you understood too much. Northampton wasn't New York or Calcutta. It wasn't even as large as the little cities to its south. As places go, it seemed so orderly. But what an appalling abundance it could be. If all of the town were transparent, if the roofs came off all the buildings and the houses and the cars, and you were forced to look down and see in one broad sweep everything that had happened here and was happening, inside the offices, the businesses, the college dormitories, the apartments, the hospitals, the police station, and also on the playing fields and the sidewalks, in the meadows and the parks and the parking lots and graveyards and the boats out on the river, you'd be overcome before you turned away. And not just by malignancy and suffering, but by all the tenderness and joy, all the little acts of courage and kindness, and simple competence and diligence operating all the time, to apprehend it all at once. Who could stand? No wonder so much remained invisible. And so, what is it we would see if all the libraries and museums across America, for just those 15 minutes, we could consider the talking, suppose we might take in case. And if, like a, could overhear thought, what would they think? What would we know? And would we be able to understand even half of the many ways of self-understanding, of self-expression, and self-rescue from crisis being demonstrated as we look? We know that the overwhelming, overabundant world is powered by irreducible facts, by amounts, speeds, costs, conditions, percentages, troops, tests, shortages, surpluses, birth, death. At times it's moved by the sheer quantity of lies we've been told and the immeasurable depth of obfuscation. Yet, everything we know and learn that moves us as individuals, everything we think of as worth knowing or essential to pursue, and everything that makes us feel and confirm our own vitality is surrounded and even created by contrasts, by the tendrils that connect our perceptions to our memory, summon the thoughts of others, and take us beyond ourselves to our community and even our nation as a place of progress and renewal. Each of us lives in multiple contexts. We see, think, and feel through their prisms. No fact has meaning or value, no shard of evidence has a place without context. Comes our complexity, mystery, and possibility. As the cover of a recent issue of The Nation, this is from February 2nd, it makes visible nearly all of the recent inauguration was an exploration of context. History, immediate and past, the power of symbol and image, and the extraordinary, and in my view, hopeful thing that has happened in the context of so much despair. Mr. Obama stands taking the oath, surrounded by the faces of Thurgood Marshall, Emmett Till, Viola the Youth, Barbara Jordan, Chief Joseph, Bayard Rustin, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Steve Biko, Goodman, Cheney, and Werner, Carol Robert, Addy May Collins, and David Richmond, Joseph McNeil. On that day, history. Contexts are invisible, and yet they are different. They explain complexity, even as they obscure simplicity. Context is complexity. Memory, implication, association, connotation, resonance, difference, the surrounding invisibilities that turn all of our hard certainties into spidery filaments, and yet create all possible progress. What is visible is evident. But it is in the invisible that we can find the truth, in the connection, in the theory, the imagination of the act, and the situation that we make beyond witnessing, because it is beyond the fact. Context are elusive. The traces of experience are constantly transmitted back to us. We do what we are given to do. We observe. We nurture. We move beyond the information. We fold, assemble, the passage, back. Think and search. In the stories that we discern out of the evidence we assemble, in the rediscovered parts of our lives and memories that somehow become clear to us over time, and in the words that we use to tell each other the meaning of our insight, in those things we find the meaning of one life. In the places that define us, in our homes, our libraries, our places of learning, keeping, classrooms, our museums, what we see and touch as evidence of diary, artifact, fabric, a tale. Whatever we can see and touch is the captive record that we're given. What is this gift of complexity? And what are we to do with it? I believe that our task in what we do with what we are given is to recombine the captive evidence with the free intellect. Use language to tell ourselves what we have seen and where we are in our lives, and then move ourselves and move each other forward, growing in complexity together, becoming something. Our task is to understand our context with as much complexity as we can possibly grasp, and to speak of what we are able to understand. This is how we transform evidence and information into knowledge, how we transform experience into story. We are learners when our language expands, when we increase the possibility that we will have the words to say the complex things we have not said before. I like to point out to my students, we can ask only the questions that we have the words to say. when we have no words, we cannot act. Not to speak is to be a captive of the unspoken. Not to discover our own place in our own time is to allow the hidden parts of experience to make us vulnerable. When we learn to think of one life as a thread, not a fragile, but a tough, essential strand, whose traces we can follow like a river, we've come to see the possibility of one life in context, the imagination of other lives in context, and the possible commons where who we are is woven into both a living culture and a human culture. This is how we will rescue ourselves. As I see, democracy requires intellect in its citizens, awareness of the values that drive and motivate human beings and nations, and the several qualities we've come to describe in combination as an open mind. We are able, I think, to live up to these challenges, even from our own small places in life. We can ask questions, and we can ask again and again. We can avoid judging. We can encourage the narrative to continue. We can see how one life varies from another in family, in economics, in education, and how it differs in health, in civic participation, in employment, and in avocation. We all differ in these and in other parts of our lives. But they do not make a difference that prevents us from understanding ourselves and each other. We are all weavers of our own strand. We know the hopes and anticipations of birth and the hardships of love. But out of 1,000 experiences, we create one life. And yet it seems to me, when we're out without speech, when we are without opportunities for self-presentation, without ways to express what we've seen and know, ways to reach with experiences and knowledge of others, we will not live up to the possibility of common life. Museums and libraries are most able to approach the complexity, passion, empathy, curiosity, and ambiguity. They are places of artifacts, records, and documents, but they are also not places, meaning that when we occupy them, we are in process and in motion by their contents and purposes. Our cultural institutions transform experience and possibility. How? By deepening it, by informing, and even healing their users. As we experience these institutions, we become more open. Our senses and our language expand. These are qualities of resonance. They imply affinity, continuity, and safety. They promise us a place of sustenance and advocacy. They suggest that there is more to understand. Places of faith are also cultural instruments of this kind. Their resonance offers solace, hope, and kindness. Hospitals are also cultural institutions whose resonance offers ideals of health and strength and longevity, even as it makes healing possible. The resonance of such places lies in the intangible gifts they offer and what changes they evoke from. Museums and libraries are also cultural instruments whose resonance is the limitless complexity of ideas and experiences offered to the individual life. But they are secular and public, they require no avowal or condition, and they exist for the common life of a community, for the aspirations of its people. Their deepest contributions to American life remain invisible, most of them. I've come to see cultural institutions as essential parts of American democratic practice. They are for our stories and national memories, for the communication of evidence and value, for observations of what we need to remember together, and for the lasting questions that remain with us always that emerge. Our national experience, as Howard Feynman makes beautifully clear in his recent book, The 13 American Arguments, lift up book and show to audience. There's the Its subtitle is Enduring Debates That Define and Inspire Our Country, 2008 publication. As Feynman makes it clear, debate has always, I mean, America has always been defined by the tension of voices and ideas. Always part of tension. Always out of tension comes some sort of accord. While some will point to the great amity and accord represented in our Constitution, never. Just take a visit, make a visit to the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, and you will be reminded that living and sometimes always meant to be new expression to its people. Feynman's 13 questions are examples of the ideas that don't go far away from even the smallest civic enterprise. Who is a person? Who is an American? What can we know and say? Who judges the law? What are the limits of individualism? America started in an argument, and it has never stopped. We are meant to be cranky about what we want. As you may know from other things that I've written, these definitive, never-ending questions are similar to the more personal questions that I see as the unfinished issues of American life. The ideas that move every one of us forward, but must be examined regularly to be certain that our thinking is contemporary and progressive. We may understand that we have been shaped by our faiths, our families, our reading, and by our education, but none of those has done us any good if we are not left with constant and pertinent questions. Ethical questions. Questions of what we are meant to become. How we are meant to teach and help those we love. What we want to happen, and how we can bring it about. You may have experienced some of this recently. Writing in December on Slate.com, Emily Yaffe described something that you might have experienced yourselves. That is the emotional phenomenon of elevation that accompanied our recent election. Even if you were not an Obama voter, you must have all felt elevated just to have the damn thing over. Researchers, and now I'm quoting, researchers say elevation is part of a family of self-transcending emotions. Some others are awe, that sense of the vastness of the universe and smallness of self that's often invoked by nature. Another is admiration, that goosebump-making thrill that comes from seeing exceptional skill in action. Dacher Keltner, the author of a new book about this phenomenon, says, quote, we had to evolve these emotions to devote ourselves into social collectives. Jonathan Haidt, a professor of moral psychology, at the University of Virginia, who coined the term or used it in this context, elevation, writes, powerful moments of elevation sometimes seem to push a mental reset button, wiping out feelings of cynicism and replacing them with feelings of hope and a sense of moral inspiration. Perhaps there is a moment of that kind at hand. In my view, we are always involved in the process of becoming stronger, even when it feels that we are not. And because we grow strong in hidden ways, we rarely understand fully that we have more competence and more capacity than we are ever called upon to show. Unless, that is, we are engaged in the kinds of conversation that place us in the midst of language that matters. And it seems to me our task now, in cultural institutions, is to change the public lexicon toward a common way of becoming something together. In my view, as I say, human beings, unless they are anesthetized by entertainment or beaten by despair, are engaged in private acts of questioning, of self-observation, and self-renewal. I believe that we cannot. At their most powerful, I believe, human beings are capable of immense acts of self-rescue, the idea that revitalizes the life and lends. Each of you may know a person who exemplifies self-rescue, or maybe one who has made steps to survive against the odds on your own. It further seems true to me that self-rescue is a prerequisite for the rescue and strengthening of others and of becoming something together. It is the human being changing, in my view, who stands at the center of our cultural institution, the human being becoming, whose resonance is courage. For the observations and processes that will help us to flourish, we require human voices in inviting places. In the presence of these questions and the ways they affect us, I see cultural institutions as places for public critical thinking and for the reflection that brings people together in progressive reciprocity. Now, I was going to call this talk progressive reciprocity, but it was suggested that that might not draw masses of people. And so I changed it. I was persuaded to change it to something that was, you know, more benign. Here's the story. Two semesters ago, I was teaching a course late in the afternoon. I had to walk to my classroom in my waiting class around dusk. I was usually late to class because on my path, right in the center of the Chapel Hill campus, a group of students, sometimes 8, sometimes 16, would gather to juggle. I hypothesize that they are participants in our new juggling studies program. Working on the BJS degree. But they would juggle the usual things, balls, pins, hoops, and they would start out with 3 and then more. And then more jugglers would be added to the exercise, right? Say 4 jugglers standing opposite each other, 2 by 2, and they would start to juggle back. They'd throw things, they'd catch them, they'd throw them back, each time keeping the speed and spin steady enough for the other person to catch, but also, it seemed to me, slightly increasing. Things would be dropped, things would be picked up, things would be fumbled and corrected. But the effect on the jugglers was progressive and reciprocal. The tension of skill and learning shared among them was mutual, self-created, completely fabricated. I propose to reinvent American cultural institutions as places for the expression of American voices and to explore, from no prior assumptions or point of view, the ways we have of discovering possibility, changing our perception of complexity. My idea is to use American cultural instruments already dedicated to the invisible actions and meanings of lives to recover the lost voices of America in mutual, self-created relationships of process. Think for a moment about the challenge we will have for the rest of our lives. Last week, I visited my friend Sonnet Takahisa, who's the director of education at a museum that does not yet exist, the National September 11 Memorial and Museum at the World Trade Center. I have not been in downtown New York since 2001, but I checked into the Hilton Millennium Hotel. She and I talked about the great challenges and ambiguities of the work of that public school. How does the severity of memory and the urge to vengeance and punishment affect the open mind of learning? What is the balance between knowledge and question? What unknowns come? How shall we construct meanings together? Make ourselves learners, ask of ourselves, what has happened? As though we knew nothing, had to learn our feelings and construct our knowledge out of. The day before, I had considered similar questions with educators at the Museum of Jewish Heritage, the living memorial of the Holocaust, at the tip of Manhattan. How our Holocaust, now that almost all of these, what are the meanings of the event in a world of multiple, simultaneous, the modern animal? During this visit to New York, I also spoke to educators at the Queens Museum of Art, where my consultant, and they're creating there a public library within the soon-to-be-expanded art gallery. This in a community where the children in public schools speak about 140 different languages at home, in addition to English, where 55% of the population over five speaks a language other than English, and where the public library collects materials in more than 40 languages. What is a library or a museum to do in such a community? What are the aspirations of the people? What is it that the community might become together with the assistance of its cultural institution, its cultural instruments? These questions are being addressed in Queen. If you have not gone to the website of the Queen's Public Library, do that. There you'll find lists of their courses and lists of their programs, such as their citizenship program, by which people study to become citizens. One day, a Thursday afternoon, I was there at a meeting right outside, right in a room adjacent to the citizenship training center, and there were about 15 or 20 people out there practicing. They also have a job bank, an office that helps people find jobs. They have a literacy center. They have an adult education program. And what's been happening now over the past 3 years, as I've been advising, they have taught literacy classes for people in from various ethnic groups, various national groups in the museum. I attended one class, see if I can remember it. I attended one class that was about performance art, encouraging immigrants to do performance art about themselves. It was taught by a Dominican who was assisted by a woman from Peru, and there were people from Algiers, from Eastern Europe, from India, and from Africa in the class. And they were multi-generational, by the way. It was held in one of the branches, one of the 60-some branches. You go to that website, you will also find a demographic tool that will allow you to go to each branch library and see the ethnic construction of the population served by that, the languages they speak, the education level that they have, all extracted from. And by the way, the art museum, rather than provide, quote, fine art, has embraced the concept of multi-ethnic exhibitions. And so every possible group is on the walls as well as in the museum. It's an example to be observed pretty closely. And now I have digressed. I never digress. Seems to me that in these places, and in every place that resembles them across the nation, those who care about history, knowledge, art, culture, and the continuities of democracy have an opportunity to learn what the voice brings to the object, to the search, to the image, to the path, how the voices add complexity and detail and express an individual integrity of observation and interest, how even the newest Americans are aspirants for themselves and their children to what America is. This is what we require in our places of public learning: complexity, passion, empathy, curiosity, ambiguity, and the large unknowns that each of us carries at any given moment. We should be asked to live up to these possibilities. My proposal is nothing new. There's never been anything simple or simplistic about America. Its complexity is overwhelming and extraordinary because it's always been grounded in process, thought, and informed act. In contexts large and small, it cannot hide its errors and losses. It cannot hide its fear, nor can it obscure its resources and its vast, vast energy. What it cannot bear, it seems to me, is fear of others, or a failure to be curious. To be called incurious, implying pre-knowledge of all the answers before the statement of a problem is finished, is the most damning. Yes, I want to cause trouble. But I'm an educator. here, and that's my job. I cause trouble in your lives. It's the kind of trouble we need in order to transform, expand, and deepen our own resonance to challenge. The nation is now engaged in unprecedented public problem solving. Though it is often evoked, the Great Depression is not really comparable to now, because the nature of information is so much more complex, and the challenges to our economy seem so far from our own hands. I want to bring communities to their questions, to the knowledge that helps to inform their responses, and to the ideas and values that will shape our policies and plans for teaching and learning, for rebuilding our institutions, and for creating new possibilities, new fields of ideas out of which we might discover what our great communities and institutions and people want to become. Children should see adults do this, so they will never think that critical thinking and its public applications begin elsewhere. And they might also know that libraries and museums exist for exactly this kind of transformation, by deepening what we think about and how we think about new things. For all the musings we've heard about Main Street, there is only one kind of place where we might go to discover our own voices. Cultural institutions, libraries, museums, other community places have a role in reconstructing American trust through face-to-face forums and conversations now that the nation is engaged in this immense work of rediscovering itself. We still have our resources and tools. We have an economy of banks and automakers, and we have an economy of information that's moving too fast for us to see. We still have greed and capitalism. We still have generosity and compassion. We still have people moving into our nation to become us, and perhaps to rescue us by transforming us. But do we have each other? My notion is that we need to replace ruthless or selfish individualism with becoming something together. As we can see in pockets of our past, it will not be the first time we've done this. It will begin with stories told in places where we live to others who sit near us and are unafraid to speak. We are unafraid to speak in the safe places we are. These are the places that open us to ourselves and the possibilities of self-rescue. I'm so grateful for the invitation.